From Portland, Oregon, we're APA Compass Radio, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show. Find podcasts of our program at apacompass.wordpress.com or contact us on Facebook. Thanks for listening to APA Compass Radio. Thanks for supporting APA Compass during our KBOO membership drive. I'm Sarika Mehta. Eric Liu is a former speechwriter and policy advisor during the Clinton White House, and he is currently the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Citizen University, which teaches the art of powerful citizenship. He is also the author of the book A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese American Dream. This is an account of Chinese Americans' history in the United States with tales of Eric Liu's own family. We had a powerful discussion on citizenship, and furthermore, this discussion occurred in the wake of the grand jury decision to not indict Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. Again, welcome to the show, and thank you for supporting APA Compass.
I'm so glad to be with you.
Your book is called A Chinaman's Chance, which is apparently an expression that I had never heard before, actually. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what it means and why you chose that as the title of your book?
Yeah, well, the phrase itself has its origins, 150 years ago when Chinese immigrants started coming in significant numbers to the United States and came as laborers and helping to build the railroads and mine mountains. And as low-wage, low-status workers, these immigrants were often given some of the most thankless, dangerous, life-threatening tasks. And the figure of speech just arose during that era that if somebody had a low chance of surviving or making it through a task safely, they had a, quote, Chinaman's chance. And that phrase stuck, and it entered into the lexicon and just became sort of a figure of speech. And then if you fast forward 100 years, in the mid-1950s, when my father came to the United States, he emigrated he'd been born in China and then went to Taiwan in his adolescence and then came in the mid-late 50s. And my dad was a real kind of an enthusiastic lover of language, a sponge for idiom and slang. He just soaked up the culture around him. And somewhere along the way, I never did get to ask him where exactly, he heard this phrase, a Chinaman's chance. He heard it, and I know I don't know whether he heard it used directed at him or he heard it somebody saying it in his presence and company without particularly noticing or caring that it might be offensive to him since it's essentially a slur. But somewhere along the way, my father heard this phrase, and being kind of a mischievous spirit and this, as I say, a sponge for idiom, he decided to take the phrase and to grab it and in a way to reappropriate it, redirect it. And so by the time I came along and I was a kid, my dad would just use this phrase in everyday speech in very prosaic situations just to, with a wicked sense of irony. And so if we were driving to the grocery store but we were late and they were going to close in 10 minutes, he would look at me and say, "Oh, Eric, I think we have a Chinaman's chance of getting there," you know. And you'd say it kind of to, you know, again, with mischief, to sort of needle me, to get a rise out of me in part. But I think more broadly what he was doing was in reclaiming and reappropriating, kind of redirecting this dart that had been directed at people like him, like me, people who look like us. He was doing a very American thing. He was claiming this language, he was claiming this country, and he was saying basically, I don't care that there are words and institutions that are rigged against me. I'm here, and I'm going to apply my own sensibility and wit and approach to claiming this country. And so it was really in honor of both that history and of Chinese Americans in general, but then that history of my father and family's migration in particular, that I gave this book that name.
More at the macro level of Chinese Americans in the United States, there's a chapter in your book talking about entirely about the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Yeah. And then Wong Kim Ark, who is the reason that we actually have this birthright citizenship law.
Yeah.
Well, first tell us about the Chinese Exclusion Act, maybe just briefly for our listeners.
Well, you know, when I was saying earlier about the arrival of Chinese laborers to the United States, these laborers who were low wage and workers that the railroads and other industrialists could, in a sense, exploit. You know, they made for great profits for capitalists, but they also made for great competition for labor, for white labor in the United States. And so there grew over the course of years economic resentment that was then coupled with just straight up racism and xenophobia and nativism directed against Chinese laborers and Chinese immigrants. And it all came to a head politically, first in California and ultimately in the Congress of the United States, when the Congress in 1882 passed the Chinese Exclusion Act. It marked the first and only time, really, in American history that an entire group of people by race, by national origin, was barred from entering the republic. And it was just basically the, you know, years of racial riots, of labor disputes, of tension, of very kind of volatile politics around Chinese migration and so forth, finally culminated in this just paroxysm of racism. And people said, okay, let's just be rid of this problem and we will now henceforth exclude Chinese. And that's the context for this fellow named Wong Kim Ark. So Wong Kim Ark was a cook born in San Francisco, and he was in the 1880s in San Francisco, decided to take a trip to visit relatives in China. And so he went to China and spent some time there. And when he came back to San Francisco, he was denied entry at the port on the notion that he was Chinese and therefore subject to exclusion under the Chinese Exclusion Act. And he argued, well, no, I'm not Chinese subject to exclusion. I'm an American. I was born here. And thus began a court conflict. He did what any good American would do at that time or today. He lawyered up. He got himself lawyers. There were lawyers that the Chinese-American community had developed relationships with over many, as I say, decades of various forms of legal and extra-legal anti-Chinese activity. And so these lawyers took up his case, and the case made its way up the federal courts, and ultimately the Supreme Court of the United States in 1898, in the case of United States versus Wong Kim Ark, ruled that the 14th Amendment, Section 1, was very plain in its language. All persons born or naturalized in the United States or subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. And Wong Kim Ark had been born here. So in this case, the Supreme Court wasn't thrilled about it, but they, as they said in the decision, to read the language of the 14th Amendment against Chinese would force them also to read it against people of French or Irish or German or English descent, and that surely wouldn't do, right? They weren't about to deport people of European descent, and so they had to acknowledge that this principle of birthright citizenship was guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. And all of that happened because of a Chinese litigant, because a Chinaman decided to take his chance in court and hold this country to its stated word. Now, that would just be an interesting history lesson if it weren't for the fact that our politics today around immigration are all about the question of birthright citizenship.
Exactly.
All of the angst that is stirred up among immigration restrictionists today is angst about so-called anchor babies, about undocumented immigrants coming across the border here so they can have kids in the United States. Kids will be citizens, and then those kids who are citizens will be able to bring in other relatives and anchor an influx into the United States. There's this kind of fear of invasion, really, that is in the psyche of a lot of these anti-immigration activists. And that is really what has shaped, you know, President Obama's recent executive action. It's what's shaped the inability of Congress to deal with this issue, because it is so beholden to a small but mighty core of rabid restrictionists. And so much of these contemporary politics today that go to the question of who gets to be a citizen, who gets to be a member of our community, who gets to be seen as us, as part of us, all of these questions about birthright and citizenship have their origins in the case of Wong Kim Ark.
It's incredible that it's exactly what you said, that it's originating from this case with Wong Kim Ark. That was certainly history that I was not aware of. But something else that I found really interesting in the book is when you're talking about this history, there's a direct quote that says, "We banned people," talking about the Chinese Exclusion Act. And you chose to say "we" instead of "they."
Yep.
Which I found really interesting. You know, you and I are both Americans. We're both second generation So I just found it really interesting that you were willing to accept this ugly history, even though technically...
Oh, but I think that, you know, that technicality is a dangerous technicality, right? It is the technicality that plenty of, you know, again, you and I are having this conversation in the immediate aftermath of the decision in Ferguson, right? And there are plenty of people, there are plenty of whites in the United States who use that logic and say, hey, it wasn't me. My family came here after slavery, so why should I be, you know, held to account or at all feel any sense of responsibility for the legacies of slavery and segregation that still play out in this to this day in communities like Ferguson? That ain't my problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my view, and the reason why I quite deliberately said we in that passage of the book, is because, look, if I'm going to say we won World War II, we sent a man to the moon, we turned back the Nazis on D-Day at the invasion of Normandy, then I don't get just to claim the good we's, right? I don't get mm-hmm. to just claim the proud parts of our history. I have to say, too, that we excluded Chinese. We decapitated tribes of Native Americans and ultimately pushed them in a concerted strategy, essentially, of genocide and isolation, that we enslaved Africans. And owning that, saying that that is a we, that we are part of, is to me what it means to be a citizen. To be a citizen of this country is to accept the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it is to accept that, you know, there is something remarkable and powerful about our unique inheritance, which is to say, we as Americans are bound together by nothing but a creed, a civic creed. And that is amazing. It's not a country of blood or tribe or territory so much as it is a country of creed. But that, to me, is not a cause for patting yourself on the back or thumping your chest or waving a flag in some jingoistic way. What that is an exceptional burden. What that is basically this giant creed looking down at you all the time saying, you still haven't lived up to me. You still aren't living up to me. You still haven't actually delivered on the promise of these stated words. And so to claim citizenship in this country is to claim responsibility for solving the deep unsolved problems, for reckoning and reconciling the deep schisms of race and class and gender and other forms of inequity, and saying, you know, that's how I claim America. It's not at all about jingoistic chest thumping.
I appreciate that, and it does give me a new perspective that with each year of life, I am owning more and more of our good and bad history. So I do appreciate that perspective. I just wanted to turn a little bit to kind of more at the macro level of the book, your personal stories with your family, especially your relationship with the Chinese language, both at what I call a personal and academic relationship, that is relationship in the family and in the community versus you took Chinese as a foreign language in college, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were talking about 80% versus 20%, the amount of immersion, use of the language.
My parents speak 80%. Chinese to me, and I would answer 80% English, right?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the ways in which, you know, language, it's actually, you just put it a very interesting way, which had never occurred to me, which is that when I took Chinese in college, I took it as a foreign language, quote-unquote, which, of course, it was not, but it was, it met a foreign language requirement, right? And a lot of what I write about in this book, sort of as the medium for unpacking questions of heritage, identity, obligation, trying to tease apart what parts of me are Chinese, what parts of me are not Chinese, what does that mean, and what does it mean in the life and the development of my teenage daughter. In all of these kind of broad philosophical questions, I try to ground it in language. I try to ground it in what it is that the learning of, the speaking of, the hearing of Mandarin Chinese, which is what I grew up, you know, surrounded by, shapes one's sensibility, shapes one's sense of not only kind of the ethical dimension of the relationship among people and things, but also just shapes your own ear and your use of language itself. Part of what I write about is how I'm quite convinced that one of the reasons why I both became a writer in general and spent some time as a speechwriter for President Clinton is precisely that growing up listening to Mandarin Chinese steeped me in a very conscious sense of the rhythmic poetic power of language, and really kind of attuned to cadence and to rhythms in a way that, and effective uses of rhythm and cadence in a way that Chinese can't help but make you conscious of if you're paying attention. But even apart from that more instrumental sense, the deeper ethical sense of, you know, Chinese is a language that is very context dependent. It lacks a lot of prepositions that we're used to in English. Tenses are often, you know, ambiguous. It's not as particularized and objectified a language as English. It is a language that depends far more on context, the context of what preceded and followed a sentence in conversation, the context of who's saying it to who. And so it just requires a far more relational mindset than English and American life requires. English and American life require a more kind of classic enlightenment, like let's break it down into its smallest component parts and let's think of ourselves as kind of atomized units that are kind of intersecting with each other and bouncing off each other. But Chinese, both as a language and as a kind of a set of cultural norms, is more attuned to this web of context, relationship, kind of mutuality in ways that I try to reflect on in the book.
The one thing I really appreciated was the last chapter, which you called Father Tongue, and it's raising your daughter, your now teenage daughter, Olivia, whose Chinese name is Ming. And you said that there was a period in her life when she was little that she wanted everyone to call her Ming, and you call it the Year of Ming, because she also grew out of it. And also your lessons with her of trying to teach her Chinese, which is a lovely bonding time that you two have. But it made me also think about the, I don't want to use the word burden because it's a very negatively connotated word, but it is a burden that first and second generation parents have, that really all parents have, with wanting to pass down this culture and language to the next generation. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge undertaking when, especially when you might be the only family of this cultural linguistic minority in your entire city, in your community. Mm-hmm. It's a huge undertaking that a lot of parents struggle with. I was wondering if you had any more thoughts about that.
Oh, you put it really well. It is a huge undertaking, and I don't make any pretense at having particularly succeeded at the undertaking. I think the best I've been trying to do in the case of my daughter is just lay enough of a foundation, expose her to enough of a sense of the language, again, the cadence, the rhythm, you know, to develop within her. You know, she does, I'm proud to say, have an intuition about when you're writing a Chinese character, what the right way to write it is, from outside to inside, from, you know, top to bottom, so forth. Like, she's gotten some instincts about that just from years of repeated exposure and practice. But, you know, after, you know, the story that I tell in the book in part about her language learning is that, well, it starts actually with my language learning, about how I as a second-generation kid growing up in a largely white, you know, neighborhood in Hudson Valley of New York, when I was sent to Chinese school on Sunday, I hated it. I hated going to it. I'd try to, you know, wish it would go as fast as it could. And there's a line in the book that says, you know, those who ignore Chinese school are doomed to repeat it. And I indeed was doomed to repeat it by trying to send my daughter to equally stultifying and boring Chinese schools. And, you know, fortunately, I knew enough to know, having experienced it, like, look, I get these schools, some of these schools, the ones that I sent her to, just were not very compelling or interesting. So I made a deal with her and said, either I'm going to keep sending you to these schools, and I admit that they're not great, but this is important that you learn this, or you and I can start doing a weekly tutorial. And somewhat to my surprise, she took me up on the latter offer. And so that was 5 years ago, and we're not religious about it every week, because particularly as she's gotten older and has more after-school activities and sports and the rest, it gets harder. But we have most Tuesdays after school spent 60, 90 minutes doing Chinese lessons. And so I do feel good about having laid some groundwork. But even after all of that, she still couldn't, if you plopped her into Beijing or even, you know, Chinatown in Seattle, would not be able to last very long or make her way. But I do think that, you know, as she grows older, and perhaps when she goes and finishes high school and whatever lays beyond that, you know, if at some point she decides, you know what, I'm motivated to want to go deeper in this, I'm motivated to want to really get up to speed on this, that it will be orders of magnitude easier for her to access that language and that heritage because of the foundation that that has already been laid.
That is absolutely true. And it's just something that a lot of people don't realize what a challenge it is when all of the cultural and linguistic insight is on you, this one parent.
That's right.
It's a lot. We get it.
Yeah. It's better than nothing, but it's not something yet.
So. Right. It's tough. Well, I know that we're coming to a close. I was going to ask you about Ferguson Matters to all of us and to other communities of color. You spoke a little bit about it previously. Do you have any last remarks that you want to share with our listeners?
Let me put it this way. One of the most chilling things to me, even in the weeks that preceded the grand jury decision announcement, was the way in which various whites in and around St. Louis and Ferguson, and for that matter around the country, some just everyday citizens, some actually police officers, started wearing badges or bracelets or T-shirts or chanting the phrase, "I am Darren Wilson." And to me, that was chilling for a lot of reasons. It was chilling because what it said was that at that time, prior to knowing anything about what the grand jury was going to find, whether he was guilty or not, that given the circumstance of an unarmed black teen being shot to death by this officer, that there were lots of people in the community and in the country who basically just said, you know what, I don't care about facts. This is a tribal A-B choice, and I'm going to choose A. I'm going to be white, and I'm going to identify with Darren Wilson and just call it, you know, that's the game. You know, and that was even before the announcement. So I think that kind of polarization and tribalization of identity is only going to get accentuated in the aftermath. And to me, this is far more dangerous than the visible danger of people rioting or breaking windows or whatever it might be, because this is a danger that is caused by an absolute willful failure of imagination and empathy. An absolutely willful failure to imagine yourself as somebody else, to see yourself as somebody else, and therefore to truly see somebody else. And I think we as Americans, whether you are Asian American like you and me, whether you are, you know, African American, whether you're European American, whatever your background is, the whole point of the experiment of this country, which is an experiment of global human consequence, because it's just never been done in the history of humans to have a mass multicultural democratic republic that stays together. The whole point of this experiment is dependent upon our ability and our willingness to really see each other, to not just tribalize, to not just see past our humanity and put each other in various boxes and stereotypes and assumptions. So I think, you know, we all have to work harder. And that's not just a statement that whites have to work harder to see people of color. I think everybody has to work harder to see everybody with compassion and humanity in the wake of something like this. That's the foundation. And then from there, we all have to, as citizens, I mean, you know, this is the work that I do in the nonprofit that I run, Citizen University. We all have to become way more literate in power, in understanding how power in civic life operates, how it flows, who has it, who does not, why that is, and how you can change that. To me, the remedies in Ferguson, there are first-order remedies that have to do with training of police and perhaps cameras to be worn by police, but there are second-order remedies that have to do with getting every single African-American in that community registered to vote and voting. And you will quickly see a change in the city council. You will quickly see a change in the police force. You will quickly see, you know, new things happening. But all of that depends on us getting literate in power and feeling motivated to actually try to exercise that rather than preemptively giving up on the possibility of exercising voice and power. And so I think if you combine that kind of empathy with a willingness to engage in power, that's what it means for us to show up as citizens for each other.
Eric Liu, thank you so much for chatting with me on APA Compass.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has really been a fun conversation, and I really appreciate your taking the time.
That was writer, policy advisor, and proud citizen Eric Liu. The book is A Chinaman's Chance, One Family's Journey and the Chinese-American Dream. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening. Right here. There ain't nothing they can tell.